Hi, and welcome to DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Len Sipes. Back at our microphones for a second time is Scott Shortenhouse. Scott is the Deputy Director, Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives with the U.S. Department of Labor. One of the things that the U.S. Department of Labor, in conjunction with the U.S. Department of Justice, in conjunction with other federal agencies, have done over the course of the last 6 years is to fund approximately 30 programs all throughout the country. But these are community-based programs, and they're faith-based programs. They're not through the mayor's office. They're not through a governmental entity. They're not through the Department of Corrections. They're not through the police department. They're community organizations, and they're faith-based organizations. And what they've done is to, after those 6 years, is to come up with a lot of results. And that's one of the reasons why we have Scott at the microphone this morning. Scott, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thank you, Len. It's great to be with you.
All right. So we did another program, and we have to summarize that program just a tad, because we were doing the first program, we really did focus a lot on this issue of faith-based organizations and what it is they do and their roles and what is appropriate and what is not. And just to summarize, we basically said that what is more important to a community in terms of its reputation, in terms of its standing in the community, than a faith-based entity, whether it's a Catholic church, a Southern Baptist congregation, whether it's a Islamic initiative, whether it's a coming out of the synagogue. These are organizations that have the trust of the community. So if they get up and say that this is something that we should do, generally speaking, there are thousands of people who would follow, correct?
That's correct. Having the safeguards in place to make sure there's no abuse on federal dollars, but the more important part is that they exist in the community, they have this very compassionate vision, and they're able to produce some very good results, and it's good public policy.
And one of the things we're going to talk about is some of those lessons learned today in this program in terms of the faith-based organizations, the community-based organizations, and what it is that we've learned from that experience. But we did, and again, the other point that we need to summarize is that we're insistent, the Department of Justice, the Department of Labor, the federal government is insistent, and our experience, both yours and mine, has been that most of the religious organizations, if not all of the religious organizations, will adhere to that. They cannot insist that the person come to church. So if they're mentoring an offender who comes out of the prison system and it's a Southern Baptist church, they cannot insist that person partake in their tenets and their or their beliefs to service that individual. So the person can go to that Catholic church and be from the Islamic faith and receive all the services on the face of the earth, and there's no pressure to embrace the tenets of that particular religion, correct?
That's correct, Len. Yeah, they cannot discriminate based on religion on their entrance to the program, and then we also put the safeguards in to make sure that any inherently religious activity is offered in a separate time and location, and there's no condition that they participate in that in order to receive the services from the federal grant.
And we both acknowledge that it's not going to satisfy the critics who believe in a staunch separation of church and state, that that we're still going to have our critics on that particular point, and we move on from there. Okay, so one of the things in terms of today's discussion, the second discussion, is going to be on the lessons learned in terms of, again, the faith-based organizations, the community organizations, and how they interact with the larger political structure, how they interact with the larger governmental structure. Because, you know, we in the criminal justice system, have a problem. We're in charge. We're not in charge of anything. It is the communities themselves that make those decisions. It is community leadership. It is, in many cases, faith-based leadership that makes those decisions. And sometimes we're not jumping up and down for joy that now that this church, this Islamic center, this synagogue suddenly has this power to make decisions about what's happening in this particular community, correct?
Correct. And I'd like to just address that a little bit from the angle of the President's Reentry Initiative, if that would be okay.
Sure, of course.
The President announced his Prisoner Reentry Initiative in his 2004 State of the Union, and from that, the Department of Labor has funded 30 faith-based and community organizations all across the country that are providing job placement, job training, mentoring, and providing other services to returning adult ex-offenders ages 18 and up. And what we've done also is the Department of Justice has provided grants for services for these men and women pre-release that have been pre-release activities include case management, vocational training, transitional plans, a risk and a needs assessment, things like that. The results that we've seen are very encouraging. Nearly 12,900 people, over 12,900 men and women have been served by these organizations. Over 7,900 have been placed into jobs, and the recidivism rate at the 1 year post release is less than half the national average.
And that's incredible. That is a wonderful result that is not the norm,
and we're very proud of that. That these organizations are proving that they're helping provide some very very good results. And so what we've seen is we are kind of creating many marriages at the local level in 30 different communities across the country between the criminal justice system, criminal justice agencies, state departments of correction, and faith-based and community organizations, many of whom have not worked together before. I think in developing these relationships, we're realizing a couple things. In creating relationships where that are functional partnerships, you have to realize the worth in both in both institutions. I think the institutions have to realize the great strengths that faith-based and community organizations can provide.
Institutions meaning government and bureaucracy.
Yeah, government, state correctional facilities, local prisons, things like
the police department.
Police department, but also faith-based community organizations have to realize the great worth that the correctional facilities, the police departments, and probation bring to the reentry process itself, and that they're all working towards the same goal. What we're looking at here, we've seen that there's been a real kind of a clash of cultures here between a lot of these organizations want to work behind the wall and to create these. Statistics have shown that if you create these relationships with these men and women before they're released,
right,
it can be far more effective.
Oh yeah.
But you've got a clash in cultures. You've got they don't speak the same language.
Right.
They've got to follow the rules when they say be here at noon for an appointment and you show up at 12:30, that creates a lot of havoc. And
right,
you're seeing that there's a clash in cultures that they have to work through these in order to to have a working relationship. What some of the things that we've seen that are very effective is creating a seamless transition plan. So if you have reentry specialists from a Department of Corrections working with parole and probation, working with these faith-based community organizations, and not having three plans,
right,
having one plan, where everybody knows what's going on with this offender, and everybody's on the same page, and who's and what role each is providing,
right,
is incredibly effective, and it seems like a basic thing, but oftentimes we're working in silos here, and not working against each other, but working. We don't even know what the others are up to. So meeting with these institutions, creating these seamless transition plans, can be effective. We've also seen that some of these they've worked with some of the courts, some of the parole and probation, to where they have created such a great relationship that it's a condition of their supervision that they participate in some of these organizations, that they share information. And I think it's also important. Results are very, very important for us, Len, and that is that everybody is accountable for their program, and that faith-based community organizations can track results and can show the parole and probation and the facilities that this is what we're doing and these are the results.
Well, obviously from the results of the program, and the results are what make it or break it in terms of our ability to tell citizens that this is a potent combination. And you have, on the first program, you mentioned that if they're in mentoring, if they have, and when I say mentoring, it could be three people on one offender, could be a one-on-one relationship, the wide variety of forms of mentoring. But that if they're mentored, they get the job and stay in the job. Mm-hmm. If they're mentored, they recidivate at a much less of a rate than everybody else. So you're bringing data to the table that certainly indicates that this is a potent sort of thing. And we within the criminal justice system have got to get over ourselves. We've got to work in cooperation with these community-based organizations, with these faith-based organizations, and develop that seamless plan that you're talking about. But even in government, that seamless plan doesn't exist.
It's true.
You know, even if you have the same agency, I was in Maryland for 14 years, and the Division of Correction really didn't talk all that much to the Division of Parole and Probation. They're in the same department, the Maryland Department of Public Safety, but there's not a lot of conversation that's going on between the two. So that sense of a seamless plan involving community-based and faith-based organizations, that's a tough road to hoe.
You're right, and we're not saying that it's easy. We know that there are a lot of barriers to that happening, but we have seen it happen. We have seen it happen in many of the 30 mm-hmm. communities that you know it is possible. And when it is done, I think that's in the best interest of the men and women that are returning. So that they don't have three different plans that they're trying to juggle on top of returning to their family and finding a job and finding housing. It's much better for the offender when these entities can work together.
What happens? What are your points that we were talking about, drawing out different points, lessons learned in terms of the community-based organizations, in terms of the faith-based organizations? What do you think are the key points?
Some of the key points, I think, are are you speaking in terms of the services that they provide
and the lessons learned.
Sure.
I mean, if I'm representing a governmental bureaucracy dealing mm-hmm. with ex-offenders, and somebody says, "Well, we're going to give $600,000 to the Roman Catholic Church," my first response is, "Oh, moan and groan." These faith-based and community organizations don't know how to manage a dollar. They don't know how to do these contracts. You know, are they going to cause me an endless amount of grief? It's the uncertainty of that relationship. And obviously, you've been successful, the U.S. Department of Labor has been successful in terms of creating those relationships, helping those relationships start, for lack of a better word, or to be successful.
Right.
So what are the key lessons learned
sure.
from doing that?
Sure, sure. I think some of the key lessons learned that we've seen with these organizations and their ability to produce good results is mentoring, which we covered in the previous program and job placement and training, but it's also leadership buy-in. I think that when you look at correctional facilities working with faith-based and community organizations, the leadership buy-in has to be there on both ends, and the folks have to know that this is a priority from our warden, from our secretary, from our director, and it's on the faith-based community organization side, it's a priority from our executive director that they work together. And second, I think this is very, very important, is that seamless case management is a necessity.
Explain what case management is.
Sure. A case manager might be when they return to the community, in the faith-based and community side of things. It's a person that kind of helps navigate their transportation, navigates their it's the person that kind of shepherds them through the program in order to find a job or to stay out of prison, and sometimes parole and probation is a case manager, can be a case manager in many grades. They've got conditions that they need to meet,
right?
Sometimes behind the wall we have reentry specialists,
right?
So these are different sort of case managers.
So it's figuring out who this person is, analyzing this person from a criminal history point of view and from a needs point of view.
Yeah.
So we can say that the guy is in on his third burglary. He's 35 years old. He has a substance abuse history. He doesn't have much in the way of a job background. These are the different things that we're going to have to focus on. We have to hold him accountable for his behavior while out in the community. But at the same time, he really needs job development. He really needs substance abuse therapy and counseling when he gets into the community. And by the way, having a mentor would be a wonderful thing for this person. So that's basically case management.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yep.
All right. So any other lessons? So we have to do case management. Everybody's got to understand the strengths that everybody brings to the table. Anything mm-hmm. else?
One thing is we have to figure out how to, the accessibility, once you identify who the players are in the community, these entities, these faith-based and community organizations. And there are many that exist in every community. We're funding 30 through the President's Prisoner Reentry Initiative, but here in Washington, D.C. alone, there's dozens and dozens of organizations that provide services to men and women returning from prison.
Right, and so, we have our own at the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency. We have our own faith-based coalition.
Absolutely.
And we're working with approximately 100 faith organizations throughout the city, and it's a powerful component.
That's fantastic. And once you identify these entities, then you have to figure out how we provide them access to these men and women before they are released. How are the facilities identifying the men and women that are returning? Is it are they alerting them when they're 2 months out, 4 months out, 6 months out? When is the community notified that this man or this woman is returning? And then second of all, how do we match up the faith-based community organizations with these men and women? You know, I was talking to the Wisconsin Department of Corrections a couple days ago, and they've just said, you know, Mondays from 3 to 4 is when the community can show up, and they can, you know, we give them a list of the men and women that are returning, mm-hmm. and they can make these connections at this time. So there's different ways to do that, but we have to figure out a way to provide access, and I think that comes from relationships.
Now, we're halfway through the program, and we haven't even hit the job component of it yet, and we have to start focusing on that on the last half of the component, but let me give you your name and telephone number and website address. Scott Shortenhouse, Deputy Director, Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, U.S. Department of Labor. Scott's telephone number is 202-693-6459, 202-693-6459. They have a website at the Department of Labor, which is www.dol.gov/CFBCI. So that's dol.gov, Department of Labor.gov/Community Faith-Based Community Initiative. I've got that wrong, right?
C for Center, F for Faith, B for Base, C for Community, and I for Initiatives.
Right. Yep. DOL.gov/CFBCI.
That's
Do I
right.
have it right? Okay. Jobs. I did jail or job corps kids in a billion years ago. I found this. Job Corps was a wonderful initiative that basically offered individuals, you know, their education, getting that GED, getting that plumbing certificate, buying them their tools, and really doing a comprehensive assessment as to who that person was, and providing that person with the wherewithal to go out and get work. And here was my assessment of my experience, my one whole year at Job Corps, which was the hardest job I ever had in my life. That's including 6 years in law enforcement. Is that 1/3 understood their circumstances and embraced that job training and that job opportunity. 1/3 were on the fence, and 1/3 you couldn't reach regardless of the circumstances. So just because you have an opportunity doesn't mean that people embrace it, and that becomes the difficulty of this whole issue of placing people in jobs, does mm-hmm. it not?
Yeah, that's true. It can be a challenge, but there's no doubt that when men and women return, one of their biggest needs is finding a job.
You sit down with that offender, and it's like, Mr. Sipes, I need to get my GED, but not now.
Absolutely.
And I need drug treatment, but not now. I need to get a job.
Absolutely.
Need to get a job with a future. That's what 90% of them will tell you upon release from prison.
Absolutely. And oftentimes, Len, one of the best social services can be a job. It can be the structure that a job provides.
Absolutely.
Working with others, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. And we all understand that. So mm-hmm. what was your experience in terms of your 30 sites throughout the country? You said that most of them found jobs and most of them kept the jobs.
Most of them found jobs and most of them kept the jobs. And I think in order to find out why they were successful, we have to take a step back and see where we came from in this area. When we were developing the Ready for Work program, we did a focus group with employers. We did two focus groups with employers.
Smart thing to do.
And we said, You know, we are developing programs that are going to help returning men and women. What mm-hmm. will help you hire these men and women as they return to the community? Mm-hmm. Is it the federal bonding program? Is it the Work Opportunity Tax Credit? What is it? And
this, we haven't even touched the bonding program and the tax initiatives. Maybe we can come back and do a third program on those two issues. But go ahead.
We could. But they said it's none of that. They said this is the heart of how and why we would hire these men and women. You know, we need somebody that can vouch for them, that can say mm-hmm. we have come alongside of them, a faith-based community organization. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a mentor or other people that can say, you know, when it's 9:05 and that person hasn't shown up, they can call an organization and say, Scott's not here.
Right.
Where do we go? I mean, businesses are in the business of meeting their bottom line.
Of course.
And
they're not social service entities. They're there to make a profit.
Absolutely. And many of them said, we would be willing to take a chance on giving a person a second chance and hire somebody with a criminal background.
But come to me and tell me that this guy is truly ready to work.
That's exactly right. They said, we can teach him the hard skills. We can teach him how to build a house.
Right.
We can teach him how to,
lay concrete.
Absolutely. And any and all of those jobs. It's give me an organization that can work with these men and women coming out, that can provide them life skills, soft skills, ways to interact with coworkers, mm-hmm. How to dress for the job, how to communicate with a boss.
You just cannot tell the boss to go pound sand.
Absolutely.
That's not going to aid your job retention.
And that is oftentimes some of those life skills trainings are some of the things that faith-based community organizations can excel at.
Absolutely. And that's such a key issue. You can mm-hmm. take a person who has spent 40 years working, mm-hmm. who volunteers to help this individual, and when this individual comes back and says, you know, the boss is on my derriere, I'm getting sick and tired of it, he or she can tell them how to deal with that particular individual.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't we all love to have that support system out there? I need it from time to time.
I would imagine
most people need it from time to time. But I mean, that's the heart and soul of this.
Absolutely. And let me just go tell you a little bit about how these organizations have set up their employment program. Oftentimes, you'll have two different positions within these organizations. One is a training specialist who is responsible for operating the classes, mm-hmm. For developing the curriculum, helping these men and women be prepared for jobs. And that training specialist works hand in hand with a job developer, mm-hmm. and their job is to work in the community, oftentimes in high growth, high demand jobs. Who will, knowing full well the laws and regulations about hiring people with criminal backgrounds, construction is a great field. Sometimes healthcare is not. So to know that, to navigate that, and then to work with these employers to sell them on hiring men and women that are coming back. I mean, it's important to know that these organizations are providing a valuable resource for employers. The cost of turnover is extremely high. We have on our website a cost of turnover worksheet where a faith-based community organization can work through what the cost of turnover is with an organization and with a business. And let me just give you an example. There was a CVS worked a couple of years ago. Steve Wing of CVS told me this story.
Okay, CVS.
Sure.
The drugstore?
CVS, the drugstore.
Okay, go ahead.
They ran an ad here in the Washington Post for lab techs and things like that. Mm-hmm. They spent about $50,000 in advertising and got zero job applicants. Mm. And they met with the pastor of Mount Lebanon Baptist Church here, Reverend Edmonds, and he said, well, why don't you just do a job fair at my church?
Mm-hmm.
And Steve thought about it and decided to do it. And I think over 250 people showed up for
right.
the job fair. More than 100 were hired.
Right.
And at least half of those or more stayed on the job for a good portion of the time. These can be these organizations can be wonderful resources for employers, especially when you look at the cost of job turnover. So for them to know their niche and to know the industries that they can go to and say, we'll provide you with a good workforce where mm-hmm. they've got a mentor and mm-hmm. they're receiving life skills and they're eager to work. Because these men and women want to work mm-hmm. and stay out of prison.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing about it is there's no doubt about that. I believe that they all are sincere. I mean, you know, the criminal lifestyle is just a terrible, terrible lifestyle. I don't care what the movies say. I don't care what the videos say. I don't care what the music says. You know, the criminal lifestyle, being in the game, being part of the lifestyle, as everybody puts it, is just death. Mm-hmm. And self-destruction. And everybody attached to the criminal justice system knows this. So if the individual can come out of prison and have that support group and have a meaningful job, hopefully something that will give that individual a future, that is leaps and bounds better than the life that they knew previously. But breaking from that life that they knew previously sometimes is the biggest barrier that we have to deal with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this touches on something that we talked about last program. I'm not going to get into it now, but the combination of employment, job skills, and job training and job placement with mentoring, where you're providing these men and women with the support that they need to navigate the job, to navigate the transit system, to navigate family reunification, can be a very potent combination that we really believe in at the Department of Labor.
How do you train individuals? Because part of this involved training, did it not?
Some of it, part of it does involve training. And I think what you'll see is with 30 different organizations and 30 different markets across the country, you're going to see different training in different areas. Mm-hmm. So really, these organizations are forming training programs according to the employers that they have marketed with and mm-hmm. that they have networked with. So our Des Moines site might have a very different training program with our Brooklyn site and our San Diego site. So it really varies across the board.
But in many cases, you don't have to, I'm going to get letters on this one. You don't have to have a bricklaying background to be a bricklayer's apprentice. You don't have to have a plumbing background to be a plumber's apprentice. And there are unions throughout the country that provide these sort of apprenticeship programs.
Sure.
And also pay them while mm-hmm. they're going through the apprenticeship
Absolutely.
Program. You don't have to know how to lay concrete, which is one of the most demanding, physically demanding jobs on the face of the earth. Somebody will teach you how to do that.
That's
so
right.
When we're talking about job training, in many cases, as one employer said to me, tell them to show up, shut up, and do what we tell them to do, and we can lead them to a great career, but they've got to be willing. The biggest thing is show up and learn and pay attention, and we'll take care of the rest.
That's exactly right. And many of these faith-based community organizations are great at taking somebody returning and making them job ready and preparing them through mock interviews, preparing mm-hmm. them through like Dress for Success programs, preparing them through life skills training to be ready on that job. And when they show up, they can learn how to, as you mentioned, lay bricks, lay concrete, build houses, do whatever, manufacturing, whatever industries they are being trained for, the employers are willing to provide the hard skills training.
Yeah, and so they don't have to go to the community college for 2 years. They don't have to go to an organization for 6 months. In many cases, what these employers are saying, and I'm probably repeating myself unnecessarily, what they're saying is, oh, just give me a person with a strong sense of work. Just give me a person who has the right attitude and who is willing to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and is willing to be out there in the dead of winter, in the heat of summer. And that person can make within the first year, $40,000 a year, and it's all uphill from there.
Absolutely.
And we can work that person from the day he comes on or she comes on until for the next 20 years.
Absolutely.
So there are ways out that don't involve an enormous amount of money, I suppose.
There are. And what we've seen also is oftentimes, these many of these organizations have wonderful reputations within the communities that they're existing. But the best selling point sometimes can be just one or two good participants that where the employer says, I'll take a chance on a couple and see how it goes. And mm-hmm. if these participants are good workers, they show up to work every day on time, they do a great job, they work well with their colleagues, and all of a sudden word of mouth spreads, and this employer will not only employ more, but he'll talk to other people within their sector, and they'll start to take folks from these programs, and success can build on itself.
Scott, there's so much that we need to talk about. We did two programs, and And there's just so much more to cover. You're a very interesting interview, and I really appreciate you being with us today.
Excellent.
Scott Shortenhouse, he is the Deputy Director, Center for Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, U.S. Department of Labor. Telephone number of 202-693-6459, 202-693-6459. The website for the U.S. Department of Labor in terms of this initiative is www.dol.departmentoflabor.gov/CFBCI. That's dol.gov/CFBCI. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Len Sipes. Have yourselves a very pleasant day.